Chapter 9. Endings and Beginnings. In London, I immediately went to Jaggers in order to arrange Magwitch's defense, but he warned me that there was little he could do. When Wemmick heard what had happened, he shook his head, muttering, "Portable property." What I think of Wemmick is the poor owner of the property. "Yes, of course," Wemmick said. Then he asked me to go for a walk with him on Monday near Walworth. Monday came, and we hadn't been walking long, when suddenly Wemmick said, "Oh, look, it's a church. Let's go in." Then he said, "Oh, look, gloves. Let's put them on." I was growing curious when suddenly the aged entered the church with a lady. "Oh," said Wemmick, "here's Miss Skiffins. Let's have a wedding." And so we did. Then we had a breakfast celebration. I was happy for the newlyweds, but worried about Magwitch. I left as soon as I could. I spent as much time as possible with Magwitch, doing my best to make him comfortable. His trial was quick, and as Jaggers had predicted, he was sentenced to death. He accepted his sentence with a peaceful look in his eyes. Then one day when I arrived, he said, "Dear boy, you're never late." "I don't want to waste a moment." "God bless you. You've never abandoned me," he said, breathing with great difficulty. "Are you in much pain today?" "Won't complain, dear boy." He had spoken his last words. Smiling at me with affection, he held my hand close. "Dear Magwitch, I must tell you something. You had a child once, whom you loved and lost." He squeezed my hand now. "She's alive, and she has powerful friends. She's very beautiful, and I love her." With a last faint effort, he pulled my hand to his lips. Then his eyes closed, and he was gone. After that, I became quite sick for a long time. Herbert had gone east, but dear Joe came to London to nurse me. He also paid off most of my debts, which came in a steady stream. When I was feeling better, he told me Miss Havisham had died and left all her money to Estella, except for £4,000 to Matthew Pocket and small amounts to other relatives. He also told me Orlick had been caught robbing Pumblechook and was now in prison. The other big news was that Biddy had taught Joe to read and write. We talked a lot, but I noticed that as I got better, Joe became less comfortable with me, and I realized it was my fault for how I had treated him before. Then one day, I awoke to find a note saying he had returned home and signed, "Best friends always." Feeling bad for not having thanked him properly, I decided to surprise him with a visit the next day. I have to admit I had another reason for visiting, to ask Biddy to marry me. After all that had happened, I had come to realize she and I could build a good life together. It was with this bright vision that I was walking toward Joe's house when he appeared arm in arm with Biddy.
"Pip!" Biddy cried. "What a wonderful surprise! We have good news to share! We've just gotten married!"
I was completely shocked, but I hid my surprise and congratulated them. Thankful I had not mentioned my plan to Joe. At dinner, I tried to show my appreciation to them. "I really can't thank you both enough for all you've done for me. I hope you have dear children to love, but please don't tell them how horrible I was, and please say you forgive me."
"Dear Pip," said Joe, "there's nothing to forgive."
"That's right," said Biddy.
When I headed back to London that evening, I felt a deep sense of peace. I sold everything I had, then I joined Herbert in the East, where I worked hard and made a modest living at Clarriker's. When Herbert went home to marry Clara, I was left in charge, and after they returned, I lived happily with them, writing regularly to Biddy and Joe. Eventually, when I became third partner in the company, Clarriker said he could no longer keep my secret and told Herbert about my role in his partnership. Herbert was touched and amazed, and our friendship continued even stronger than before. We were not rich, but we had a good name, working hard and honestly for our profits. The years flew by. I had not seen Joe and Biddy for 11 years when one evening I opened the old kitchen door of our old home on the marshes. There, as healthy and strong as ever, sat Joe, and beside him on my own little chair sat a little boy. "We named him after you, Pip," said Joe, delighted. Little Pip and I talked a lot, and we understood each other very well. Joe and Biddy had a little girl, too, who lay sleeping in Biddy's arms after dinner as Biddy and I talked. "You should marry," said Biddy gently. "I'm already quite an old man, Biddy." "Dear Pip," she said, touching my hand, "do you still think of her?" "Oh, I don't think so, Biddy." "Tell me as an old friend." "My dear Biddy, I know that was just a dream, and the dream is gone now." Nevertheless, I knew I would return to the old house that evening alone. I had heard that Estella's life had been unhappy. She had separated from Drummle, who had beaten her. Then I had heard he had died 2 years before from an accident when he was whipping a horse viciously. For all I knew, she was married again. It was early evening when I arrived at the house and saw that everything had been torn down. A cold silvery mist had veiled the afternoon, and the moon was not yet up. The stars were shining now, and the evening was not dark. I was walking along the ruined garden path when I saw a woman standing there. She said my name in surprise. "Estella!" I cried. "I've changed so much. I'm amazed you recognize me." The freshness of her beauty was gone, but its indescribable majesty and charm remained. There was a gentleness in her once proud eyes and once unfeeling hands. "After so many years," I said, "it's strange we should meet like this, Estella, where we first met. Do you come back often?" "I haven't been back here since." "Neither have I." The moon began to rise, and I thought of Provis for a minute. "I often wanted to come back, but so many things happened. Poor old place," Estella said with tears in her eyes. Not knowing that I saw them, she said quietly, "Were you wondering, as you walked along, how the house came to be left like this?" "I was." "The ground belongs to me. It's the only possession I haven't given up over the years."
"Is it going to be built on?"
"It finally is, so I came to say goodbye." "And you?" she asked, with a touching interest in her voice. "Do you still live abroad?"
"Yes."
"You're doing well, I'm sure."
"I work fairly hard and get a sufficient living, so yes, I'm doing quite well."
"I've often thought of you."
"Have you?"
"Recently, very often. There was a long, hard time when I didn't allow myself to remember what I'd thrown away when I was so ignorant. But since things changed, I've given it a place in my heart."
"You've always held your place in my heart," I answered. Then we were silent again until she spoke.
"I didn't expect," said Estella, "to say goodbye to you when I came to say goodbye to the house. I'm so happy I can."
"Happy to part again, Estella? To me, the memory of our last parting has always been sad and painful."
"But you said to me," replied Estella, "God bless you, God forgive you. And if you could say that to me then, you won't hesitate to say it to me now, when suffering has taught me to understand what your heart used to be. I've been bent and broken, but I hope, into a better shape. Be as thoughtful and good to me as you were, and tell me we're friends."
"We're friends," I said, and we walked together.
"And we'll continue to be friends apart?" said Estella. I took her hand in mine, and we went out of the ruined place, and as the morning mists had risen long ago, when I first left the forge, so the evening mists were rising now. In all the broad stretch of peaceful light they showed to me, I saw no shadow of another parting from her.